Okay, let's continue with the readings and then get back to the next topic. Reading number 5 is about the topic of noble. Why is this a noble path? Basically, it boils down to that last paragraph, which is the noble search. It's the case where a person, being subject to birth, seeing the drawbacks of birth, seeks the unborn, unexcelled rest from the yoke, unbinding. Being subject to aging, illness, death, sorrow, defilement, seeing the drawbacks of aging, illness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeks the agingless, illnessless, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, unexcelled rest from the yoke of unbinding. Rest of the yoke, unbinding. Okay, this is the noble search. So this is what's noble about the path. It's leading to a noble goal. It's also noble in the sense that all the means that take you there are noble as well. I mean, you're asked to be virtuous, you're asked to be generous, you're asked to be discerning, all of which, you're asked to be compassionate, all of which are good qualities of mind. I bring this up because there's a new Buddhism dictionary that's out there, basically says the Four Noble Truths are not noble and the Eightfold Path is not noble. And you sort of wonder, why bother saying that? Similarly with a passage on right, this is the example. Suppose a man in need of milk, looking for milk, wandering in search of milk, would twist the corn of a newly calved cow. If he would twist the calf of the newly calved hole, even when having made a wish for results, having made no wish for results, both having made a wish and having made no wish. This is typical of the Pali Canon. Neither having made a wish nor having made no wish, he would be incapable of attaining results. Why is that? Because it's an inappropriate way of obtaining results. So in the same way, if you engage in wrong effort, wrong view, wrong resolve, wrong speech, wrong all the way down, you're not going to get effort, you're not going to get results. However, if you follow it the right way, then you will get results. So that's what's right about the path. It actually works. And if there are any questions that are coming up at any point, just let me know. Okay. And then we have two analyses of the path. These go through the different factors. Let's just touch on these briefly and then look mainly at the relationship among the factors too. Okay, you can start with right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, right view here is knowledge in terms or with regard to stress, the origination of stress, the stopping of stress, and the way of practice leading to the stopping of stress. This is called right view. This is basically the Four Noble Truths. And notice that it's so in terms of or with regard to. What this basically is getting at is you see things from this framework. These are not just four interesting facts about stress, but you look at your experience using this as a framework. Notice there's no I or me in this framework. It's just this is where the stress is, this is the activity that's causing it, this would be the stopping of it, and this is the activity leading to the stopping of it. That becomes the framework with which you look at things, because each of those categories involves a different duty. The Buddha is not imposing these duties on you, but he says, if you want to put an end to stress, this is what you got to do. As was just talking with Joseph now, the duty with regard to stress or suffering is to comprehend it. The duty with regard to the origination of stress is to abandon it. The duty with regard to the stopping or cessation of stress is to realize it, and the duty with regard to the path is to develop it. Now, three of those duties actually involve passion. Three of them involve dispassion, the fourth one involves passion. Dispassion for the stress itself, dispassion for the stopping of stress. And to get to that third noble truth, the stopping of stress, dispassion for the origination of stress, and then to get to the stopping of stress requires dispassion for craving. The path, though, requires a certain amount of passion in order to do it. You have to put some passion into doing concentration, put some passion into doing mindfulness practice, put some passion into developing right view and developing right speech and right action. Which means that the path basically functions on two main levels, is the developing part, and then eventually you're going to have to let go of that too, because it is something fabricated. It basically does its job, and then once it does its job, that's the last thing you let go of. But you will have to let go of the path at some point as well. which is another reason why it's a noble path. It's, it doesn't just keep you on the path forever. It delivers you to a place where you don't have to be on the path anymore. It's right view. Right resolve, the resolve for renunciation, basically the resolve to abandon sensuality, i.e., as we mentioned this morning, this tendency the mind has to feed off of sensual thoughts, sensual plans. Resolve for non-ill will basically means resolve for goodwill. A resolve for harmlessness means basically resolve for compassion. Now, those two latter two are very closely connected. And so, in the practice of metta, or loving kindness, or goodwill, comes under the function, comes under the factor of right resolve. This too, together with right view, is considered one of the discernment factors of the path. And the discernment here resides in the fact that you see that the cessation of suffering is something that you have to work toward, and therefore you resolve on acting in a way that would lead to that. So it's not just a sort of theoretical understanding of things, but it's also an understanding that there are duties that come with these truths that you want to follow. Then based on that, you develop right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech is abstaining from lying, in other words, misrepresenting the truth. Abstaining from divisive speech, speech that divides people apart from each other, in other words, either to break up a friendship you see happening, which you feel is threatening, or to prevent one from happening. Abstaining from harsh speech when you speak just to hurt people's feelings and no other purpose. And then abstaining from idle chatter. This is right speech. Of those, there's only one that has a precept, and that's abstaining from lying. Because there are times when what would technically be, say, divisive speech, you know, you see someone getting involved with somebody who's going to hurt them, you're in a position, you are allowed to warn the first person, hey, this other person is, you know, it could potentially hurt you. And same with harsh speech. If you feel that the only way you're going to get through to somebody is to speak really strongly, then that would be considered an exception. Abstaining from idle chatter, there is no way there can be a precept against idle chatter. So you have to decide to be on the path, though. You can say, okay, this social grease kind of talk I'm getting involved in, and that's basically what it is, keep relationships going. You have to remember sometimes too much grease mucks up the engine and it won't run anymore. So you have to ask yourself exactly how much social grease should I get involved with and how much is too much. Right action, abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining, and in this version it says abstaining from sexual intercourse. In other versions it says it's abstaining from sexual misconduct. I think this particular passage, abstaining from sexual intercourse, this was applying to the monks and nuns, and abstaining from sexual misconduct applies to lay people. Sexual misconduct would be having sex with someone who's underage, someone who is already married, or with a person who's taken a vow of celibacy. Right livelihood is defined in the most vague terms. Having abandoned dishonest livelihood, you keep your life going with right livelihood. Okay. Doesn't explain much. The Buddha gives some examples in different texts, although there's one text in particular that's interesting here because of the etiquette around the way he responds. An actor comes to see the Buddha and says, I've been told by my teachers that if you are on stage entertaining people, making them laugh, if you happen to die, then you will go to heaven, the heaven of laughter. That's what my teachers have told me. What does the Buddha have to say about that? The Buddha says, don't ask. The guy presses him three times. Now, in India, that meant if you ask something three times, you're serious, you really want the answer. So the Buddha basically said, you know, if you're up there trying to give rise to greed, aversion, and delusion in people's minds, and you yourself are motivated by greed, aversion, and delusion, then when you die, you go to the hell of laughter. Which is different from the heaven of laughter. In the heaven of laughter, they laugh with you, right? So I think this is one of the reasons why the Buddha is deliberately vague about dishonest livelihood, because he's not on a campaign to end certain livelihoods. If people ask him, is this a good livelihood for me, and they're serious about it, then he'll tell them. There is one passage where he says for followers of the Buddha, the five trades that you should avoid, trade in living beings, trade in meat, trade in poisons, trade in alcohol and other intoxicants, and trade in weapons. Just stay out of that. And if there are any questions as I'm going along here, just raise your hand and let me know. Yes? You have one? Carpentry is fine.
It was just a comment that that would wipe out a large part of the world's economy.
Yes. Yes. It would. Okay. And also that passage about the actors, one of the reasons why you don't see Theravada monks palling around with actors and actresses. Okay. Right effort. There's a case where you generate desire, endeavor, activate persistence, uphold, and exert your intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of the abandoning of evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the maintenance, non-confusion, increased plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. This is where we're actually getting into the practice of meditation. And we'll be going into this in a little bit more detail tomorrow, but for now I'd like to point out the fact that there are a couple of places here that are especially interesting, especially the one that says generating desire. This is the part of the path where desire is actually part of the path. It plays a good function, that you want to abandon unskillful qualities and you want to prevent them from arising. And you want to develop skillful qualities, and then once you've got them, you want them to grow and bring them to their culmination of their development. There are four different activities here. So it's talking about how there are four different types of right effort. One issue that's not addressed in this definition is how much effort is enough. There are other passages in the canon that indicate there are two things that you want to look at. One is how much energy do you have at a particular time, what you're capable of, and then base your efforts based on how much energy you've got. The story goes that there was a monk who was born and he was so tenderly brought up that he had hair on the soles of his feet. In fact, word of this gets to the king, and the king is really curious, and so there's an invitation for the young guy to come and visit the king. And the parents read the invitation, and they said, there's only one reason why the king would want to see you. He wants to see the hair on your feet. And so they instruct him on how to sit politely in front of the king so the king can see the hair on the bottom of his feet, i.e. sit cross-legged like this, so without not putting your feet out in front of you like that. At any rate, he ends up ordaining as a monk, does walking meditation until his feet are bleeding, and he's getting upset. He said, I still haven't gotten anything out of this practice except for bloody feet. Maybe I should disrobe. Suddenly the Buddha appears in front of him. He says, were you thinking of disrobing right now? And can you imagine you're sitting and meditating and getting kind of lazy, and all of a sudden the Buddha appears in front of you? And so he says, yes. And then the Buddha says, when you were a layperson, did you play the lute? Yes. He said, when the lute was tuned too tight, did it sound right? When it was too loose, did it sound right? He said, no, it has to be tuned just right. He says, in the same way you tune the level of your energy, and then you tune the other five faculties, or four other faculties to that, i.e. your conviction, your mindfulness, your concentration, and your discernment. So let's say if you're coming home from work and it's been a long day, you're not going to sit down and say, I'm not going to get up until I've achieved the unexcelled, right self-awakening. You say, I'm going to get through the hour, and that's enough for that night. Other nights, though, when you have more energy, put in a little extra effort. So that's one of the issues about what is just right, i.e. the level of energy you have. The other issue has to do with the specific task that's facing you. As the Buddha said, there are some causes of suffering that will go away when you just look at them. These are the ones that have been kind of hiding deep inside your mind, and when you excavate them and look at them, they just kind of wither away. There are others, though, where you actually have to exert an effort to get past them, and we'll talk about this in more detail tomorrow. So again, the amount of effort that will be just right at any one time depends on, one, the level of energy you have, and then, two, the task that's facing you. To back up a minute, we talked about generating desire. This is where the element of motivation comes into the path. the different ways you motivate yourself to stick with the path or to give up something that you're particularly attached to. And your reasons could either be heedfulness, realizing if you don't do this, there's going to be danger. Compassion for yourself, compassion for other people. Being inspired by the example of monks and nuns in the past, being inspired by the Buddha's example. You can also have a sense of humor about your defilements. It's interesting that in the canon, most of the humorous stories are in the Vinaya, which is the part that has to do with the monks' rules. They have origin stories for the various rules, and then many of them are actually quite humorous. And I think the purpose of that is, one, is to get the reader to see that particular action and see how really ridiculous it is. And so the next time they're tempted to do it, they realize that from the outside it looks pretty ridiculous. And then the second one is when you're learning a code of behavior like this, and if you have the feeling that the people who have made up the rules have no sense of humor at all, it's going to be really hard to be on the side of the rules. But if you see that they have a sense of humor, they have an understanding of human nature, then it's a lot easier to be on the side of the rule makers. Two of my favorite stories from the Vinaya. One has to do with a monk who apparently had psychic powers, and he does battle with a fire-breathing serpent and ends up defeating the fire-breathing serpent. And word of this gets out to the populace, and they want to make merit with him. And so they go ask the monks and say, what is it the monks don't usually get in their alms round? And we would like to fix something special. And they ask the royal monks, and they ask a group that says, you know, we don't usually get hard liquor. So the next morning, this monk is going on alms round, and everybody has a glass of hard liquor for him. And so he passes out in front of the city gate. The Buddha comes along with some other monks and sees him and says, oh, let's take him back. So they carry him back to the monastery. And they lay him down on the ground with his head toward the Buddha and feet in the other direction. And as he's lying there, he doesn't know where he is. So he starts tossing and turning around. Finally ends up with his feet right at the Buddha, which is not very polite. And the Buddha says, in the past, wasn't this monk deferential and respectful toward us? Yes. Is he deferential and respectful now? No. And in the past, did he do battle with the fire-breathing serpent? Yes. Could he do battle with a salamander now? No. So that's why we have the rule against taking alcohol. There's another one where there's a monk he's got psychic powers, but he doesn't have that very good a memory, and so he's only memorized one of the Buddha's teachings. And every now and then he's appointed to be giving the instructions to the nuns. So this one time the word gets out to the nuns that this is the monk who's going to be giving the instructions, and they talk among themselves, and they said this instruction is not going to be effective because he's just going to repeat that same stanza over and over and over again. And so they go, and he deals with formal preliminaries first, and then says, okay, here's today's instruction, and he starts repeating the stanza over and over again. And the nuns turn to one another and say, didn't we tell you it's not going to be effective? Well, he overhears them. So he levitates up in the sky, divides himself into many different images of himself, emits smoke, emits fire, emits water, and the different images of himself repeat that stanza and many other stanzas of the Buddhist teachings. And the nuns are saying, wow, there's never been a talk this effective. Well, he gets carried away, and he continues the show until after dark, and so then they're sent back. And back in those days, the nuns had their monastery in the city, and back in those days, when the sun set, the gates of the city were closed, so they had to spend the night in a pavilion outside the gates. Then the next morning, when the gates are open, the nuns come filing into the city, and everyone says, ah, here come the nuns back from spending the night with the monks. So this is why monks are not allowed to teach nuns after dark. So that's another way you'd motivate yourself to get engaged in right efforts, to have a sense of humor about your defilements. A sense of shame, which we talked about earlier, also works here. You'd be ashamed not to be able to give up something that you should have given up a long time ago. So that's right effort. Right mindfulness. And then right concentration. The three of these are very intimately connected, because in right mindfulness you have the factor of ardency, which is basically right effort. So basically right effort becomes the kernel for right mindfulness. And then right mindfulness becomes the theme for right concentration. So basically the instructions for right mindfulness are here are instructions how you get the mind into concentration. And you can take it one of four topics: body, feelings, mind, or mental qualities. And so, for example, the body, remain focused on the body in and of itself, i.e. not in terms of how the body fits into the world, but just the body on its own terms. Ardent, that's the right effort part. Alert, you're watching what you're doing. And mindful, you're keeping in mind the fact that this is where you want to stay. And at the same time, you subdue greed and stress with distress with reference to the world. In other words, any distractions that come up, you just let them go. Now John Lee wrote a book on this topic, and he focuses on those three qualities: ardency, alertness, and mindfulness. But remember, mindfulness is keeping something in mind. In this case, you've got a topic you're keeping in mind. You're keeping in mind the fact that you need to abandon anything that has to do with the world outside. You're focusing just on the body in and of itself, for example, the breath. And then you bring these three qualities: ardency, alertness, and mindfulness to the process. That's right mindfulness. And as you get the mind into right mindfulness, then it goes into right concentration, which, depending on the level of the focus, the intensity of the concentration, comes into four basic levels. First, there's the first jhana, secluded from sensuality, i.e. thoughts about sensual pleasures. Secluded from unskillful mental qualities, you remain and enter in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of seclusion accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. In other words, you're directing your thoughts to the breath, you're evaluating the breath so that it becomes more and more a place where you want to settle down with. And as a result, there's a sense of rapture, a sense of fullness in the body, and pleasure, a sense of ease. Then with the stilling of the directed thoughts and evaluations, you enter and remain in the second jhana. This is where you basically become one with the object of the meditation. Rapture and pleasure born of concentration, unification of awareness, free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. Then with the sense of rapture becomes gross, you focus in on a more subtle level of ease. So with the fading of rapture, you remain equanimous, mindful, and alert. You sense pleasure with the body. So the mind is equanimous, but there's a sense of pleasure in the body. You enter and remain in the third jhana, which the noble ones declare equanimous and mindfulness. Mindful, you have a pleasant abiding. And finally, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with the earlier disappearance of elation and distress, you enter and remain in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. That's right concentration. So that's one analysis of the path in which the factors are more or less linear. You start with right view and work through to right concentration. Any questions on that passage? Yes.
So, is that on? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it looks like, so right mindfulness is first, and that, it looks like the satipatthana, right? Mm-hmm. And then the right concentration comes afterwards, which right. is samadhi. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it just seems like a lot of what you hear a lot of is that the satipatthana is linked more with vipassana. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then if you're going to do any, in order, a lot of what I've heard a lot of is you do the samatha and you try to get your samadhi happening, and then you go to vipassana. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. It seems like in this, and over and over and over again in the suttas, it seems like you develop your mindfulness,
right.
And from your mindfulness, and that's how you get your concentration.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Part of the equation of satipatthana with vipassana comes from a belief that originated in Burma in the 19th century, which is that the Satipatthana Sutta was a complete explanation of meditation practice, that this is all you need to know. If you actually look at the sutta, though, the Buddha starts out with this full formula for right mindfulness, and then he answers questions only on one part, which is, what does it mean to keep focused on something? Like keeping focused on the body, what does that mean? Keeping focused on feelings, what does that mean? And the whole rest of it, ardent, alert, mindful, keeping putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world, that gets dropped. That's not explained in the sutta. So he's telling you right up front, he's not giving you a full explanation of it. But when you interpret it, say, well, this sutta is a complete explanation. There's no mention of ardency, and there's no mention of the other factors that would be required for putting the mind into concentration. So they focus on that. Well, obviously, there's nothing you have to do with these things. You just note them as they come up, note them as they pass away, which is basically skewing the meaning of the sutta because it's taking it out of context. And in the canon, there's never any mention of doing vipassana without jhana. And also, the definition of vipassana is not a technique, and it's not satipatthana. It's analyzing things in terms of the fabrications. Excuse me. I should get this away. So. Mm-hmm.
So you can use mindfulness, because I find for myself, my practice seems to be a lot pretty opposite to what a lot of what our teachers have been saying. But the mindfulness actually makes my mind settle down,
right? Mm-hmm.
So that then they say, oh yeah, but this is where your insight is, mm-hmm. And then so for me, if there's any other thing that goes jhana or whatever. That's where the insight is, not the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the canon, when they talk about the mind giving rise to insight, it's either right in jhana or right after. Because the mind has to get that still in order to see things clearly. Questions? Yes. Floating mic.
The description of the first jhana, mm-hmm. in a way, it seems almost disarmingly, the bar almost seems disarmingly low. Mm-hmm. Like speech has stopped. Directed thought and evaluation are still pleasant. There's rapture and pleasure, mm-hmm. or seclusion. It seems, when I hear the teachings on jhana, it sounds like something quite rarefied, but mm-hmm. when I read the description of the first jhana carefully, it sounds like something
you could do.
Kind of mundane. Yeah. maybe that's been happening since first time I sat down to meditate.
Well, so, you have to be really with the object.
Okay.
For it to count. I mean, the word jhana is related to a verb jayati, which means to burn with a steady flame. And Pali has different verbs describing different ways of burning. I've forgotten what it is, but there's a different word for, say, a wood fire burning. But if you have an oil lamp burning with a steady flame, the word they use is jayati. And so it's that same kind of steadiness that they're talking about here. Now, the directed thought and evaluation are basically there, focused on the object. It's like when you're focused on the breath, you're evaluating, is the breath good, is it not good, what can it be done to make it better? And if you're really sticking with it, and there is a sense of rapture and a sense of pleasure, that would be the first jhana.
So it's the steadiness is kind of the sign.
The steadiness is important, yeah.
Okay. And how does that differ from the... how does that differ then from the unification of awareness?
Okay, in the first jhana, it's like the breath is here and you're right here, kind of hovering around it. In the second jhana, everything just melds together. It's like you feel like you're one with the breath.
So I'm sorry, my question is from a ways back. I understand that suffering is to be understood, mm-hmm. but I also, the concept of dispassion, mm-hmm. I guess I'm a little unclear about how to understand something and be dispassionate, what the line is between those two qualities.
Okay, what you're trying to do is understand to the point of dispassion. You understand something so well, you say, I've had enough of this. That's real understanding in this case. Because as long as you go for the suffering, as long as you cling to the suffering, so as you don't really understand that it is suffering.
So the the compulsive feeling is absent then.
Right.
Is that the difference? That's what I get out of what you're saying.
Yeah, there's just no compulsion in it. And you have to remember that when you're engaging in suffering, I mean, you actually are engaging in it. You're not just on the passive end of it. There's part of the mind that's going out there and creating something out of this, which is then coming back as suffering. And the fact that you're out there still trying to feed off it shows that you, one, don't understand it well enough. Because the Buddha gives the example of, you know, understanding that this may taste good and it looks good, but it's going to be poisonous. And if you still go for it, it shows you really don't understand that it's poisonous. But if you really understand, hey, this is poisonous, no more. I'm not going to fall for the pretty color, and I'm not going to fall for the delicious taste. And that's when you really understand the poison. That's the analogy that he gives. Question?
Ajahn, I'm a parent, mm-hmm. and so a teacher of sorts, I suppose, trying mm-hmm. to, mm-hmm. you know, raise our two girls. And you sometimes talk about the committee, I think the committee of the mind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, as a teacher, if you found that a technique to be helpful in helping somebody counteract sort of, there's a lot of worldly dhammas
right.
that children get involved with,
right.
mm-hmm. you know, digital and otherwise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very challenging. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they say things like, I can't do this, or, you know, as a parent, you want them to mm-hmm. feel a sense of can do mm-hmm. rather than can't.
Yeah.
And so just
Well, just ask them, you know, who's speaking when they say, I can't do that? Mm-hmm. And is that somebody you can trust? So that they don't feel that they have to identify with every voice that comes up in the mind. And, you know, give them a little bit of training and mindfulness so they can sort of step back out of their thoughts a bit and then say, okay, when you come back and look at this thought, like what's the tone of voice? If somebody else were saying this, would you be persuaded? Or is this, if someone's saying this, would that be a person you would like? That kind of thing. And it's okay. The fact that it's there in the mind, they don't have to be embarrassed about it. Because that's the other problem. They think, you know, they start denying that voice is there, and then it just goes underground. It's okay, there is this member of your committee. You probably picked it up from somebody else. And it may be hanging around for a while. So just learn to accept the fact, okay, this committee member is there, but I don't have to listen to it. And learn how to recognize the different disguises that it puts on. And it helps to negotiate the fact that they're going to have lots of conflicting ideas and conflicting emotions. And it helps them to negotiate them, I think, a lot better.
Sometimes I think also, sometimes try to make them aware that these thoughts come and go.
Right.
Like, because they get upset about something, and then like a few days later it's like, oh, you remember when...
Yeah, well, that was 2 days ago. That's... Okay, let's go in the next passage. This is the one that where you actually have right view, right mindfulness, and right effort revolving around each of the factors. And it also gets into the distinction between mundane factors of the path and noble factors of the path. And the two factors where this is especially important are right view and right resolve. Okay, you've got wrong view. And this actually was a view that was propounded in the Buddha's time. There's nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. We talked earlier about what this means. In other words, people have no free will. Either that or the recipients of the gift or of the sacrifice are going to be wiped out anyhow, so why bother? Belief that there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world, no next world. In other words, there is no rebirth. There is no mother, no father. In other words, your parents are not worthy of gratitude. There's nobody out there that you have any special debt of gratitude to. There are no spontaneously reborn beings, i.e. there are no hell beings, no heavenly beings. And there are no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. In other words, there's nobody really knows whether there is rebirth. This is all wrong view. Now there's mundane right view, which as we said earlier is the right view that leads to rebirth, siding with merit. There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. In other words, these activities have value. There are the fruits and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the next world. There is rebirth. Your parents are deserving of gratitude. There are heavenly beings and hell beings. They're called spontaneously born because they don't have parents. They just appear like that. And there are those who, having practiced and practiced rightly, proclaim this world and the next world after having directly known and realized it for themselves. If you have conviction in these principles, that leads you to act in ways that will actually lead to a good rebirth. That's why this is called mundane right view. And then transcendent right view is the discernment, the faculty of discernment, the strength of discernment, analysis of qualities, path factor. All of these are basically seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. That's noble right view. Now you try to abandon wrong view and enter into right view. This is your right effort. You are mindful to abandon wrong view and enter into right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Then they have right view about the different factors of the past. So these three qualities, right view, right effort, right mindfulness, circle around right view. They also circle around right resolve. Now right resolve, mundane right resolve, is what we've already seen. Resolved on renunciation, on freedom from ill will, and from nonviolence or harmlessness. I didn't check my translations before I printed this out. And then noble right view, noble right resolve is the thinking, the directed thinking, the resolve, the mental fixity, transfixion, focused awareness, verbal fabrication, i.e. directed thought and evaluation of one developing the noble path. In other words, this is the first jhana. That's the highest level of right resolve, getting the mind into the first jhana. Then the passage goes on about applying the same analysis to right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then says that once you have all of these factors together, then any concentration endowed with these factors would be right concentration. Are there any questions on that passage? This introduces a more complex relationship among the factors. You've got right review coming, right view coming back and applying to all the different factors, right effort and right mindfulness being applied to all the factors. Yes, floating mic over here.
On page 4, when I read the short sentence, there is mother and father, and I read that and I spent quite a bit of time just pondering it, and it made me think that Buddha saying that the phenomena can have like multiple lines of causality mm-hmm. necessary for something to happen. Does that make sense, or it's a wrong interpretation?
Well, in the context of the discussions that were going on at the time, mm-hmm. when someone said there is no mother, there is no father, that meant you don't owe your parents any gratitude.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because they have no special relationship to you. They had to give birth to you. They had to raise you. They're not responsible for their niceness. And the Buddha is basically saying, no, they had the choice. I mean, there are cases in the canon where people give birth to kids and they put them out on the trash heap. You know?
Okay.
Your parents didn't do that.
No. Thank you. And another question. Beings spontaneously being reborn.
Mm-hmm.
I got stuck a bit on that part. Having a feeling that It's feels like there's a break of causality, like in a sense, like
that's not what it's meant. The spontaneous reborn means that they don't have parents.
No parents.
Yeah, like you die from here and you become a deva. You don't have to have deva parents. You can go straight to your deva pleasures.
Okay.
Same if you went to hell.
Not much else. Just spontaneous rebirth, yeah. Felt to me like there was.
It's probably not the best. It's not the best translation, but it means basically that you don't have parents.
Okay.
You are reborn at that level because of your karma from the past. Without the need for parents to provide a body for you,
could it be like the continuation of a being without a form aggregate, like you know the feelings, perceptions, and the rest, like perdures or goes on?
Well, sometimes people get reborn as devas and they forget their human lives because it is in terms of the aggregates. I mean, they actually get a new form. And because there's a discontinuity between moment by moment of the different aggregates, it's not the same feeling or the same perceptions. Now, they may have some memories of the past life. There's a great Ajahn Lee story about a woman who does one good act toward the end of her life and then has a heart attack. And because of that one good act, she gets reborn as a deva. But she doesn't have the best deva palace or the best deva food. And she starts thinking about, you know, why did the other devas have more than I do? And she reflects on her previous lifetime, and she realizes it was only really one good meritorious act she did. And so she goes down, and she finds a meditating monk, and she just stands near him, ready to perform any service possible. And he sees her; he's psychic enough. And the story is not in the canon. I can only think of one way Ajahn Lee knows about this. And so he basically says, "Hey, out! You had your opportunity when you were a human being, and you didn't take advantage of it. Let the human beings have their opportunities." So the deva has to go back to her inferior palace.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ajahn, could you say something about this siding with merit?
Okay, merit here is basically the kind of activity you would do that would lead to a good result in a future lifetime, at least to a good rebirth. That's what it means to side with merit.
Mm-hmm. Ajahn, aren't some of these contemplations, spontaneous rebirth, or aren't they almost like imponderables? That they don't, that we shouldn't concern ourselves with them too much at this state, present moment?
What I would say is there are people who find comfort in the idea that, you know, when you think about the virtues that make a person a deva, that you've got some of those virtues. That's actually one of the recommended meditations. For giving rise to a sense of self-esteem or a sense of self-confidence. The other thing that's worth knowing is that there are some people who actually experience these things in their meditation. And, you know, the Buddha has a framework for understanding this, and it's really good to have that framework in the back of your mind. So when some radiant being comes in and says, Eric, I think you should do XXX, and you have to remember, okay, now, would the radiant beings, what? How much do they know, you know? they may know something, but they may not, you know. You think about all the stories in the canon. I mean, there's some very knowledgeable devas, and there's some really dumb devas. There's one about the deva who propositions the young monk. He's coming out of the river, he's just taking a bath, and he's just wearing his underrobe, and apparently she really liked him. So she comes down out of her tree and says, hey, you know, you're wasting your youth. Enjoy sensuality, and then you can, when you get old, then you can become a monk again. Now, fortunately, he was already a non-returner, so he was not interested. But it's a warning, you know, watch out for devas. And the other reason it's good is that I had a student, actually a Canadian student, who started meditating when he was a teenager. And his background was Roman Catholic. And he started seeing these beings around in the different houses out in the fields and whatnot. This was in Saskatchewan. And given his background, beings like that could only be of one or two kinds, either angels or demons. And these were obviously not angels. So it freaked him out, because that was the only alternative he could think of. These are demons around here. I better stop meditating. So he did. And then years later, he got back into, he found out about Buddhism, started meditating again. And that gave him the framework for understanding the stuff that he was experiencing. So you're not too scared by what you see, and you're not too overwhelmed by what you see. And it's good to have this framework in the back of your mind. So it's not imponderable, it's just the question, is this relevant to me right now? Mm-hmm. And if you don't find it relevant, just say, file it away, and maybe someday it will be. Other questions? Yes. Traveling Mike.
Just a quick question. I think I was puzzled recently to come across the teaching in the canon where it describes the second jhana as the end of right resolve. Mm-hmm. Now, I assume I should take that only to mean that, like, in for the duration of the meditation, right resolve has disappeared. Right resolve is still a factor.
You're right. It's still a factor in the path, okay. But at that point, because right resolve is a directed thought and evaluation. It has to evolve. It involves some verbalization of that kind. Whereas in the second jhana, that verbalization is not there, and so there would not be any conscious right resolve being talked about.
Okay.
In the
okay.
mind, yeah.
But on a biographical level, the right resolve remains.
It's still there, and when you get out of the second jhana, the right resolve would still be there.
Okay.
Okay, that's the introduction. We're almost halfway through the retreat. So now we're going to go through the individual factors. Let's start with right view. Okay, there are three levels to right view. We've already encountered two of them. There's mundane right view, and there's noble right view. And then there's a third level of right view, which is kind of the ultimate level. It's on the verge of awakening. And to give you a kind of sneak preview, it's when, as in a John Munn's terminology, the Four Noble Truths become one. In other words, there's one truth, and that is whatever you encounter, you let go. Now, this is functional only on the level when the path has been completed or the path has been fully matured, and it's done its work, and that's the point where you let go even of the concentration, you let go of the discernment, and that's when the mind can enter into awakening. So there are three levels altogether. Mundane right view, as we've seen, has to do with karma and rebirth. Okay. Stated in simple terms, it's simply that good actions with skillful intentions lead to good results, actions with unskillful intentions lead to bad results. The good results are experienced as pleasure, the bad results are experienced as pain. When you look more deeply into the issue of karma, though, you find that it becomes very complex. In fact, there's one point where the Buddha said that is an imponderable. The results of karma, how they get worked out. You get the question, you know, what about the Jews in World War II? The Jews were exterminated. What was that kind of karma? Was that? He said, you can't really explain it. It's just too complex. The Buddha was not using the doctrine of karma to explain that kind of thing. However, the complexity of karma comes from this fact. You've basically got, in any moment, you've got the results of past actions coming in, you've got your present actions, and you've got the results of your present actions all combining to make your present experience. So what's coming in from the past is a series of potentials. And the image the Buddha gives is of a field full of seeds. You've got different seeds in your karmic field, and some of them are about to sprout. Now, you can water some of them, which makes them sprout faster. You can water some other seeds, and because they're not ready to sprout, then no matter which water you put on them, it's not going to respond. But you do have some choice as to what's sprouting, what you're going to focus on, what you're going to try to make something out of. You see this when you're sitting in meditation. You focus on some parts of the body that are painful, other parts of the body are pleasant. you've got the choice. Where are you going to focus? In other words, just focus on the pleasant parts so you can give rise to a sense of concentration that will then give you the basis for looking at what is painful. And without so much the idea of wanting to get rid of it, but trying to comprehend it. So at any one moment, you've got these different potentials that you can focus on. This also means that even though karma coming in from the past will tend to lead to certain results, the state of mind you have in the present moment is what determines how much you're going to suffer from them or how much pleasure you're going to get from them. The analogy the Buddha gives is of a big lump of salt. He said, if you put that lump of salt into a small cup of water, you cannot drink the water because it's too salty. But if you put it into a large river, and assuming the river is clean, you could drink the water out of the river because the amount of water is so much more. He said, in the same way that if your mind is, you have narrow mind and you are easily overcome by pain and pleasure, and if you have no virtue and no discernment, then your mind is like that small cup of water. Little things coming in from the past can make you suffer a lot. If you have developed the unlimited states of mind, i.e. unlimited goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy, or equanimity, you've trained the mind so it's not easily overcome by pleasure or pain, and you have virtue and discernment, your mind is like the river. It's able to, you can still experience the experience of those the results of that past karma, but it hardly touches you. So what you've got is not that karma is not tit for tat. In other words, you kill three flies and you're going to have to die three times. It's not that kind of equation. There are tendencies that come in from the past, but if you can train your mind now so it's not likely to suffer from past bad karma, which is one of the reasons why we meditate. They don't have to suffer so much from it. It also means that things are not ironclad in terms of the results, so that you do have some freedom of choice in the present moment, and that freedom of choice is what we're actually focusing on. The Buddha gives another analogy for that, the effects of karma, and it's not quite the analogy is not as pleasant. He's basically saying it's like the theft of a goat. Your past bad karma is like a theft of a goat. And your mind state in the present moment can either be the mind state of a rich person or of a poor person. The poor person who gets thrown in jail for stealing a goat, or the rich person who everybody says, okay, that's okay. You stole a goat, no matter, it doesn't matter. Which points out the fact that karma is not necessarily just. Sometimes people are accused of believing karma because they want the world to be a just world. But the way the way karma works out is not necessarily just. Angulimala is an example. He killed all those people and then became an arahant and literally got away with murder. And we all like to identify with Angulimala. We're thinking if there's hope for him, there's hope for us. But you can imagine how the people whose relatives were killed, people who were terrorized by Angulimala, how they felt. And the story actually goes, people would throw things at him when he was on his alms round because they were so upset. But as the Buddha pointed out, if we want a world in which freedom is possible, then justice is not necessarily going to happen. Because after all, the Buddha taught the end of suffering. Even if you deserve to suffer, he can teach you how to end suffering. Putting deserve in quotes. He doesn't ask you, is your suffering deserved? Or not deserved? So that's something to think about a bit. I'm writing an article right now on how the Buddha, in placing the various virtues, places wisdom over justice. Because a lot of times our justice is based on ideas, well, so-and-so hit so-and-so first, or so-and-so did something small, but then the other person came back with an entirely inappropriate response. And so there's a beginning to the story and there's an end to a story, and you kind of figure out the calculus of who was more wrong or who was more right. But if you have all these rebirths, when does the story begin? And when does it end? How can you figure out who did what to whom first? And so our ideas of justice don't fit into this kind of worldview, or at least the idea that there is an objective standard of justice that is imposed on everybody that doesn't fit in. So we're going to put that article out on Dhamma Talk soon. There's a famous story in Thailand of Somdet Do, who was a famous monk in the 19th century. A young monk comes in to see Somdet Do and complains about some of the monk who hit him. And Somdet says, well, you hit him first. The monk says, no, I did him first. He just came up out of nowhere and started hitting me. I didn't say anything or do anything bad to him. And he's like, it just hit me. And somebody else said, no, you hit him first. And so this monk gets frustrated, so he goes to see another senior monk. The other senior monk comes to see Somdetto and says, what's up? And Somdetto says, well, obviously some previous lifetime he hit the other one first. who wants to get involved in who hit who first? So, okay. So, and as we said, also talking about the complexity of karma, the fact that you have freedom of choice in the present moment is why you can practice. It also gives value to generosity, gives value to gratitude. Because everybody has freedom of choice, so you're grateful for the choices they made that were actually helpful. And you try to take advantage of the times when you feel inspired or you feel that you have the freedom to give. So, the teaching on mundane karma also makes a distinction between skillful and unskillful karma. And the Buddha starts with a particular list. Under skillful karma, you have three types of bodily action, i.e. no killing, no stealing, no illicit sex. Under verbal karma, no lying, no divisive speech, no harsh speech, no idle chatter. And under mental karma, you have no inordinate greed, no ill will, and then right view. That those are the 10 types of skillful karma. The 10 types of unskillful karma would be the opposites of those. And then the roots of skillful karma, roots of unskillful karma would be passion, aversion, and delusion. The roots of skillful karma would be lack of passion, lack of aversion, lack of delusion. And there's a set of duties with regard to these. You are to abandon unskillful actions and develop skillful ones. This is one of the few teachings that the Buddha says is categorical, i.e. it's true across the board for everybody in all situations. Now, beyond that list of specific skillful and unskillful actions, the Buddha says you have to develop your own mindfulness and alertness to notice when you do something, whether it's appropriate or not, kind of more refined level of observation. And the best analogy I can give here is up in Alaska, you know, they used to have those big bear awareness signs to let the people from down south know about bears and how to behave around bears. But I love that bear awareness. And it starts out with a list of do's and don'ts. A bear charges you, do not run. Raise your arms up high so you look bigger than you are. Speak to the bear in a calm, reassuring voice. And the bear charges you, do not run. If the bear attacks you, lie down, play dead. And it's all sets of do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts. Then to that point. Then the next point comes up, if the bear is chewing on you. And apparently this differs between grizzly bears and brown bears. But they also say, try to notice if the bear is chewing on you out of curiosity or hunger. And if it's chewing on you out of curiosity, continue to play dead. Because it will lose curiosity pretty quickly. If it is chewing on you out of hunger, fight back for all you're worth. Mm-hmm. So that requires a lot of mindfulness and alertness. So there's some areas of life where the do's and don'ts don't are not enough. You have to use your own powers of observation. And that's also part of this mundane right view. Okay. Are there any questions on mundane right view before we move on? We have 5 minutes before the break. Any quick questions? Or one good long question? Yes, thanks. Traveling mic.
Would you have advice on how to turn a displeasure into pleasure? Mm-hmm.
Like a physical pain or
anything? Like I was thinking about effort, like to prevent unarisen, unskillful quality, to arise, and so on, that formula.
Okay.
And I was thinking, like, what gets in the way of that kind of effort? Well, when something is pleasurable, well, it's easy to go along with it and mm-hmm. just do it. But when something is unpleasant, and then I want to effort towards a goal, and but there's this unpleasant experience, mm-hmm. then maybe there's something I can do to
reframe.
Yeah, to change it, transform it, or and so on.
Okay, we could think about here's an opportunity to develop character. Here's an opportunity to develop my strength. Think about here is, you know, all the inspiring examples you've read about people in the past who've done difficult things, and so here's my chance to do it. That student I told you about, the monk who used to be a cook, he likes to put himself into difficult circumstances, and part of it, when he comes out, he has a great story to tell. And I think that's why he does it. But also that's how he gets himself through the experiences. When I get out of this, I'm really going to have a good story to tell. You know? So that's another way you could think about it.
Well, that's very useful to me because I like to tell stories. I have lots of stories about stuff that I've done. So, well, that's good. Good advice. Thank you.
Anything else? Question over here. Here's a mic over here.
It's on. I'm not sure where it was. I tried to find it, but you mentioned a skillful action being inordinate greed. Mm-hmm. It sounds like an oxymoron.
A skillful would lack of inordinate greed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that. Because I mean. There is something as such a thing as ordinate greed. In other words, you see, I would really like to have that, and I will do everything that is legal and appropriate to get it. That's okay. That's not necessarily unskillful. It's when the greed goes beyond bounds and says, I'm willing to do it, whatever it takes, no matter what, to get that. And that becomes inordinate. Okay. Okay. Yes?
A question about the two monks and one hitting the other monk. Mm-hmm. What about the monk who did the hitting? Mm-hmm.
He wasn't complaining.
But it's unvirtuous. I mean,
exactly, it's unvirtuous. Just the fact that someone hit you in a previous lifetime doesn't give you the right to hit them back. And this is, again, where karma is not a matter of justice. Because now it becomes that monk's karma. Or to someone who says, well, obviously this person is poor and they've done some harmful, they're now in prison, and now as a prison guard I get to beat them up as much as I like. Okay, now that prison guard, that becomes the karma of the prison guard. The bad karma of the other person does not excuse the bad karma of the prison guard. Question?
So following on this, then, are we letting, like, so obviously in this time, there's a lot of opportunity to observe this mm-hmm. in today's life. What is it, I guess, just the three, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion that we're letting go of then? Mm-hmm. So when somebody has that sense of wanting to inflict justice on somebody else, mm-hmm. their, whatever mm-hmm. they're calling justice. Mm-hmm. It's those are the things where they're, so what are we asking people to let go of? Like, that's the greed, hatred, and delusion.
Okay, it's because there's a lot of greed, hatred, aversion, and delusion in the justification around that. I want to hit this person and I can justify it and I can use my reason, but the reason is skewed by the greed, aversion, and delusion.
So even in, like, the criminal code, although there are some fundamental things about, you know, like, we have that because it adds order to society in a certain sense.
Yeah, we don't have to kill or the criminals.
No, of course, totally agree. But yeah. But I mean, it's like very ingrained in Western culture anyways.
It comes from monotheism, the idea that there is an author to the universe who has decreed this is the purpose of the universe, and anybody who doesn't follow in with that purpose is going against the divine will, therefore they deserve to be punished. Whereas in the Buddhist universe, it's kind of like a committee project.
I'm in government too, so
yeah. And it's all very very random. But I mean, the Buddha never tried to get in the way of the conduct of the justice system of his time. But he never tried to give a dharmic justification for the way it was applied. He said that's just the way of the world. And sort of stayed out of the issue.
Thank you.
Okay, it's time for a break.